Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and the title of this audio is Why It May Be Impossible to Disqualify Trump from the Presidency. Can former President Donald Trump be disqualified from another presidential term? The answer to that question partly hinges on the answer to this one. Does the disqualification language in the Constitution's 14th Amendment apply to a candidate seeking the presidency? In the Colorado case on the subject, the trial judge answered, no, it doesn't. She concluded that the 14th Amendment's disqualification language applies to many offices, but not to the presidency. Therefore, she dismissed the case against President Trump. But the state Supreme Court answered yes and reversed the trial judge. This issue probably will not go away. The judiciary of other states and the U.S. Supreme Court may have to consider it. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment disqualifies anyone who has, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States, end quote, from certain listed offices. The listed offices include Congress, presidential electors, and I'm quoting here, any office under the United States. The presidency and vice presidency are not listed, at least not explicitly. However, the justices of the Colorado Supreme Court, like many other writers, claim the presidency is included because it is an office under the United States. The Colorado justices wrote, quote, when interpreting the Constitution, we prefer phrases normal and ordinary usage over secret or technical meanings that would not have been known to ordinary citizens in the founding generation, end quote. But that comment sells the Constitution's framers short. They were highly skilled legal drafters who knew what they were doing. The document they produced was straightforward. It had no secret meanings, even if modern writers ignorant of 18th century conditions might think it did. The court's comment also sells short the people who ratified the Constitution. The founding generation was an unusually literate one on legal matters. The phrase office under the United States was the obvious successor to the extremely common British term office under the crown. As former subjects of the British Empire, members of the founding generation had heard and used that expression all their lives. We must never assume the Constitution's ratifiers did not understand a legal phrase in a legal document as important and as closely examined and as widely discussed as the Constitution. The Colorado justices disregarded substantial evidence that when the Constitution uses the phrase office under the United States, the Constitution refers only to appointed offices, such as the Secretary of State or the Secretary of the Treasury. This evidence suggests office under the United States does not include elected offices, such as senators, representatives, the vice president, or the president. Here's the background. The Constitution uses certain key terms over and over again. Among them are the words office and officer. Sometimes the Constitution does not modify those words, but on other occasions, the Constitution adds phrases such as of the United States or under the United States. Over a decade ago, Seth Barrett Tillman, an American legal scholar working in Ireland, noticed that the use of these office phrases is not haphazard. He found patterns. These patterns appear both in the drafting process and in the finished Constitution. Professor Tillman also identified other historical facts consistent with the patterns. Since that time, Professor Tillman has been joined by another legal scholar, Josh Blackman. Together, they've tried to reconstruct the meanings of all these words and phrases. They concluded that, as the Constitution suggests, the bare term office includes the presidency. But they also concluded that when the Constitution modifies that word with of the United States or under the United States, it means only appointed officers. They also found, by the way, a distinction between officer of the United States and officer under the United States, but that distinction is not important here. Professors Tillman and Blackman therefore determined that neither office of the United States or office under the United States includes elected positions. Excluded are members of Congress, the President, and Vice President. Professors Tillman and Blackman backed this up with a fair amount of proof. For example, in British practice, the term officers under the Crown referred only to appointed, not elected positions. Also, the Constitution states that the President, quote, shall commission all the officers of the United States. That's Article 2, Section 3. In other words, the President gives each officer of the United States papers that confirm and explain the officer's authority. But commissioning yourself would be, shall we say, awkward. And almost no one has ever seriously suggested that the President must commission himself or other elected officials. So the President must not be an officer of the United States. Additionally, the Constitution, Article 2, Section 4, authorizes impeachment of, and I'm quoting here, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States. If the President and Vice President were officers of the United States, there'd be no need to list them separately. And again, the Constitution treats the oaths of the President and members of Congress separately from the oaths of officers of the United States. Then there's the Constitution's Foreign Emoluments Clause. That's Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8. The Foreign Emoluments Clause prohibits officers under the United States from accepting gifts from foreign officials. Yet President George Washington accepted such gifts without any public objection. True, most people were leery of criticizing Washington, but President Thomas Jefferson was otherwise criticized savagely, but not for the gifts he received from foreign officials. All this suggests that the members of the founding generation did not think of the President as an officer under the United States, covered by the Foreign Emoluments Clause. And again, during President Washington's first term, the Senate asked Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton to make a list of all officers under the United States. Hamilton made the list, and his list included all appointed positions, but it excluded all elected ones, including the presidency. Now, I'm not saying that Tillman-Blackman evidence is absolutely conclusive. Some of the events they rely on occurred after the Constitution was ratified, and as I've explained elsewhere, evidence from after the Constitution was ratified generally should receive little weight in reconstructing how the ratifiers understood the Constitution several years earlier. On the other hand, the Tillman-Blackman evidence from the 1790s, just a very few years after ratification, does have the virtue of being uncontradicted. So what does the 14th Amendment mean by officer under the United States? I began to immerse myself in the record of the American founding over 30 years ago. Much later, I turned my attention to the adoption of the 14th Amendment. Congress proposed that amendment in 1866, and its ratification was completed in 1868. What I discovered is that those responsible for the 14th Amendment, the drafters, proposers, ratifiers, mostly were well-meaning, but they were nowhere near as competent as the framers and ratifiers of the original Constitution. Those responsible for the 14th Amendment simply did not have the founders' wide knowledge or drafting ability or understanding of what they were trying to say. This, I believe, is a principal reason disputes over so many key 14th Amendment phrases continue to afflict us today. There is a rule of legal interpretation that tells us what to do when faced with this kind of uncertainty. The rule is that when an amendment uses a word or a phrase from the original Constitution, we should presume that the amenders use the phrase the same way the original Constitution does. This suggests that office under the United States in the 14th Amendment means the same thing as in the original Constitution. And to my evidence, my knowledge, there's no strong evidence to the contrary. So if the president is not an officer under the United States in the original Constitution, then he's not one of the 14th Amendment either. Well, why exclude the president from the disqualification clause? Why would those responsible for the 14th Amendment disqualify a former insurrectionary from most other offices, but not from the presidency? This is another area in which the amendment's drafters and ratifiers were exasperatingly unclear. But here are some possible reasons. First, all of the disqualified officers listed in the 14th Amendment are chosen within individual states, senators, representatives, state officials, and so forth. Without a disqualification rule, the chances were good that one-time Confederate states, such as Virginia and Mississippi, might choose former Confederate insurrectionaries to serve in state positions or in Congress. On the other hand, the president and the vice president are elected nationwide. When the 14th Amendment was adopted, the 11 former Confederate states comprised less than a third of all states, and they held less than a quarter of the national population. The chances of a former Confederate being elected president were effectively zero. Another reason why the authors of the 14th Amendment disqualification clause may not have included the presidency is that the presidency is a national office. And although it's a national office, the mechanics of presidential elections are fixed by state officials within each state. If a presidential candidate could be challenged as a former insurrectionary, state officials would have to determine whether this was true. The conclusion might differ from state to state, resulting in the very situation that threatens us now. The threatened uncertainty may have induced those responsible for the 14th Amendment to avoid that risk by excluding presidential candidates from formal disqualification. After all, the chances of a former Confederate being elected president were nil anyway. Thirdly, the 14th Amendment permits Congress, by a two-thirds vote of each house, to remove a disqualification. Those responsible for the 14th Amendment may have concluded that if a former rebel was by some miracle elected president, then his election represented forgiveness by an authority even higher than Congress, the people of the United States. And fourth, if the presidency were among the offices from which a candidate could be disqualified, a former insurrectionary seeking the job might bargain with Congress to remove the disqualification. This could lead to all sorts of corruption. It might also result in the presidency's submission to Congress. These are all serious considerations, and they should not be dismissed lightly. I'm Rob Nadelson. Thanks for listening.